This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello, and thanks for joining me this Tuesday afternoon here on the Country Hour right across Western Australia. I am Kate Forrester. Coming up between now and 1 o'clock, if you've noticed a few more crayfish popping up in the shops lately, you're not imagining things, because this week marks the start of the annual White's migration of the Western Rock Lobster. Now, that means, because I just learned this, that that's when newly molted rock lobsters all pivot northwest and make their march into deeper waters off the WA coast. So shortly you're going to hear from one fisher more about that and how he is feeling. So thanks for your company this Tuesday afternoon. 12:06 on the Country Hour right across the state. And today I'm actually going to kick things off with a conversation we were having on yesterday's Country Hour about the rising populations of rabbits in Western Australia. Yesterday we heard from landowners across the state who say anecdotally rabbit numbers are at record highs and many are frustrated that they can't do much about them. If you've got something you want to share today on the topic of rabbits, you can be part of the program and have your say. It's 0448 922 604. Neville Wall lives on a 120-hectare property near 2J, about 90 kilometres northeast of Perth. He's been there for 3 decades now and says he's never seen so many rabbits.
In the last probably 12 months, the numbers have just seemed to have exploded. I don't know if it's because of the long, soft season and there's been more feed around or something, but right at the moment, I've never seen as many as we've got now.
And are they doing damage to crops and that sort of thing in the area, Neville? What are you noticing there?
Yeah, they are. We've got a lot of neighbours who are cereal. They do just cereal crops. And they are starting to mention now that the rabbits are making a bit of an impact. They always made a little bit of an impact, but they just seem to be steadily progressing and progressing further into the crop now.
As a landholder, you're seeing this problem and you know that something needs to be done. What do you do?
It's a good question, because we've sort of tried everything. We've rang whoever we can ring to try to find out if they can re-release the virus, and we've been told that they work in the town areas before the rural areas. We can't get access to 1080 because in a community like 2J there's too many hobby farmers around. They tell us to use the grain on a season like this season when there's a lot of feed around. They don't eat the grain, and we also find that it affects the bird life and other wildlife around the place as well.
So they're not going to go for a poison piece of grain, particularly if there's still anything green hanging around at the moment. That's what you're seeing.
Yeah, the only time where we found that they actually ate it was at the height of summer when there's hardly any grass around, but they also have to eat a lot of it to make it work.
Can you keep on top of them with a rifle or not really?
I used to shoot them more than I do now when I was a bit younger. But what I find is once you start shooting them, they just get gun shy. We do have some people come around at night and go rabbit shooting, but I'm sure it helps, but it's no way going to get on top of it.
You've been in that area for a long time. I think you said you've been there 30 years. Have you noticed the efficiency or the effectiveness of Khaleesi virus when it comes through? Do you think that it's wearing off in terms of its efficiency?
It seems that it is. When we first moved there, the rabbit population would get quite large, and then you'd see the virus would kick in and it would drop down to almost nothing, and then the population would regrow and then the Khaleesi would take it out again. But now we don't seem to be getting that same pattern. Now the numbers just seem to stay consistent and slowly increase. So I think they must be forming some sort of immunity to it or something, because it's definitely not as effective as it used to be.
Does that worry you when you think about the numbers that you're seeing now and where that could potentially go?
It does worry me, because the Khaleesi and the myxomatosis were the only really options we had to get rid of big numbers of rabbits. As we were saying, shooting and poisoning and stuff will get rid of a small amount of the rabbits, but it won't get rid of enough of the population.
And we're hearing that this is a problem in other states and in other areas of WA. Do you feel that government has enough of a handle on what this problem is actually looking like at the moment and where it could potentially go?
No, I don't think they do. I sell agricultural sheds as my job, so I drive all over Western Australia from Esperance up to Northampton and further, and all the farmers, I've been doing it for a long time, I know a lot of cockies all around WA, and I talk to them regularly about it, and almost all of them are saying the same thing, that they've never seen the population as big as it is now. Or even when you talk to the old blokes, who do have a bit of memory of when it was a real problem, they are really worried that it's getting back to what it used to be.
Neville Wall lives on a block northwest of 2J that's being heavily impacted by rabbits, and he was speaking with Joe Prendergast. And I did find it interesting to hear him say how, being a shed builder, he travels right across the southern part of the state for his job, and everywhere he goes, farmers are telling him the same thing. Rabbit numbers are out of control and they want more to be done, so not just a isolated issue, seems very widespread. 11 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Well, the head of Australia's Invasive Species Council says bureaucratic delays are crippling pest control efforts nationwide. And that's one reason why rabbit numbers are on the rise. Jack Gough wrote to the federal government back in April calling for urgent funding to fast-track a new biocontrol virus. Jack, from your perspective, what's driving rabbit populations to such extreme levels, not just here in WA, but right across the country?
Yeah, look, this is a national problem, and WA is not the only place that I'm hearing farmers, land managers screaming about the numbers of rabbits that they're starting to see. And that's because of a couple of things. One, we've had in many parts of Australia a few relatively good seasons, and so obviously there's more feed on the ground. That means that that breeding cycle is faster. But what's really happening here is that the efficacy of those biocontrols, the viruses that have kept rabbit populations in check since the 1940s or 1950s, the most recent release of that was in 2017. As you get to about 10 years after one of those viruses has been released, we know that you get a significant reduction in the efficacy. That's why we need to treat dealing with rabbits is a national priority, and that means investing in the next round of biocontrols.
So what's the main barrier here, Jack, that's stopping us from getting on top of this problem? Is it scientific constraints? Is it a lack of funding? Or is it just simply a lack of urgency from the government?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, since 2022, we haven't had any funding for rabbit biocontrol pipeline. And that was a decision that was made by the government. My understanding is that it was made because the proposal that was put together didn't quite make it through the competitive round of grant funding via the CSIRO. And that meant that we just don't have one right now. And that's not good enough. This is a national priority. We are going to continue to see rabbit numbers climb while we don't have new biocontrols. It takes time to get biocontrols to work and to develop them. We're talking probably at least 10 years for the development of a new virus. Right now, rabbit numbers across Australia are at densities we haven't seen since the mid-90s, since 30 years ago, and that's because we don't have that next biocontrol ready to go.
So is it fair in saying that you think the government have dropped the ball on this one?
Absolutely, they have dropped the ball. The federal government, unfortunately, a lot of the programs we've seen about these research decisions have moved to what's called a competitive grant funding process. Sort of, you know, lots of people bid in, and whichever looks the best and rises to the top of the pile gets the funding, and the others, you know, sorry, mate, come back next time. Instead of a strategic approach, which identifies national priorities that we're then going to invest in. Clearly, stopping rabbits taking over our continent again is a national priority, and it's something that should forever have ongoing funding for and shouldn't be subject to the whims of those competitive grant rounds. But that shift is why we don't have that funding now. There's a decision that needs to be made by the federal government, and this is really important because people on the ground can do, you know, a huge amount of good work to try and control rabbits at a local scale. But that is not going to massively impact on the population. We know, for example, that in the 1940s, Australians were probably eating and exporting around 40 million rabbits every year and having absolutely no impact on the population. What regulated the population then was the boom and bust cycle of droughts. But since that first development of myxomatosis and the release of it in the 1950s, myxomatosis saw a 99% reduction in rabbit populations. Then they started to build up again. Then we had the rabbit flea, and they dropped again. We then had the introduction of the next Spanish rabbit flea to see them drop again. And then in the 90s, the introduction of the Khaleesi virus strain, which knocked them down again by about 98%. Well, those numbers are back on the rise.
Well, and I was just going to jump in there. Sorry, Jack. Farmers here in WA are telling us that they've never seen rabbit numbers like this. And some that we've spoken to have said it. They believe it's because rabbits are becoming increasingly immune to Khaleesi virus. What do we do about that?
The answer is that biocontrols are extremely effective at controlling invasive species. But they are a time-limited intervention. You have to keep investing in that next pipeline of viruses. Otherwise, the population that remains builds up an immunity to it over time. That's what we're seeing now with rabbits. And then, you know, the simple maths of exponential population growth mean that what seems like a very low population suddenly starts to explode. And what I often say about invasive species is no one cares until everyone cares about invasive species. And often then it's too late. We should have been investing in this over the last 5 years really heavily so that we were in a position, hopefully, in the next couple of years to be introducing that new virus. Instead of doing that, it was sort of let slide. And now we're in a position where if we get the funding decision for that investment via CSIRO tomorrow, we're still looking at 8 to 10 years until the next virus. So this is going to be one of the biggest political issues over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, I predict, because when rabbits are out of control, everyone sees them everywhere. They impact directly on our environment. They are the highest impact threat to species on the brink of extinction. Over 300 of our species on the brink of extinction are directly threatened by rabbits. They're an enormous challenge for agriculture, reducing productivity, damaging infrastructure, and they are also a pest in people's gardens in cities. So this is something that will galvanize the population. The problem is we needed government action while the numbers were really low. And often what we get is complacency driven by the effectiveness of biocontrols. So this needs to be a permanent ongoing introduction of funding. And without that funding, it's clear the federal government will be dropping the ball on a nationwide problem.
You are listening to The Country Hour right across Western Australia. It is 17 past 12 and I'm chatting to Jack Goff, who is the CEO of the Invasive Species Council, and quite a few of you on the text line wanting to have your say and share your thoughts on the situation with rabbits when it comes to your place. Justin from Harvey says, I've owned a property in the Harvey Hills area for 20 years. Rabbits have never been this bad as they are this year. Thanks for sharing, Justin. Colin says, Khaleesi virus seems to be working in the Mount Barker area. Maybe high rainfall has an impact. It's an interesting one. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. You can do so as well on 0448 922 604. Jack, back in April, you co-signed a letter calling on the federal government for funding to fast-track a new biocontrol virus. What response, if any, did you get?
Yeah, so we wrote to the Federal Labor Party, the Federal Liberal National Party, to the Greens, and said to everyone ahead of the most recent election, like, we need to cut through the bureaucracy on this and we need a decision. And it needs to be made at a political level that this is a national priority. Unfortunately, none of the political parties took up that opportunity to really represent what's needed for Australia on this rabbit issue. We did get a response from the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins, where she pointed to some of the bits of ongoing funding, sort of $500,000 for control programs and things that are going on. But let's be clear, that is just putting Band-Aids over bits of the problem. If we don't have the investment in a biocontrol and that research pipeline via CSIRO, then we are not going to see the level of reduction in that population needed to mean that farmers, to mean that the environment gets a break from an out-of-control rabbit population. And in a couple of years' time, I can tell you, all those listeners who are writing into you now, there's going to be tenfold the number of listeners writing in.
If that funding were approved tomorrow, Jack, in an ideal world, and it was $15 million you were asking for, how quickly could a new virus realistically be developed and rolled out?
Yeah, so look, the timeline is somewhere in the realm of 8 to 10 years. Of course, we saw with COVID that when something becomes a priority of government, these things can happen a lot quicker. You know, you sort of get what you pay for in terms of timelines. So realistically, we're talking 8 to 10 years. So there is a process ongoing right now. Decisions are being considered. So the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions with the CSIRO have put together a package for essentially what they've called a National Rabbit Biocontrol Accelerator project that will manufacture new viruses in the lab every 5 to 10 years. That decision to fund that has to go through about 4 layers of bureaucracy before it's signed off. And my expectation is that we would be very lucky to have a decision by next budget. And I assume that it could be the, you know, the budget in 2027. Whenever we get that funding, that's when the go, you know, we reach go for the starting line of that 8 to 10 year process. So numbers of rabbits above what they were really since 1995, and they're only going to go up.
But Jack, you keep mentioning the CSIRO, and last week we heard about those significant job cuts to the organisation. Does that heighten your concerns about the future of where your research and the priority that the government is placing on science? Does that concern you?
Research is essential when it comes to biosecurity. A lot of the issues that we have, whether it's established pests and weeds or it's stopping things at the border or it's new biocontrols, they rely on scientists doing the work to develop novel solutions. And that requires a pipeline of ongoing funding and funding certainty. It definitely was disappointing to see the cuts. It was particularly disappointing to see that biosecurity and the environment were two of the areas that were specifically targeted for cuts. I think these need to be national priority areas for the government. Clearly, we do not invest enough in science, and this is costing our nation. You know, like if you just take this rabbit issue, the predictions are that for every 10 years we don't have a rabbit biocontrol, we're talking about $100 million per year increase in the cost to our economy. So this is a massive cost that we already know can be dealt with, but it requires ongoing funding certainty for our research bodies and a value placed on them at the centre of dealing with some of these biosecurity solutions.
You're in Canberra today meeting with the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins. Is this issue front and centre in that conversation?
Yes, I'm with the Queensland Agriculture Minister, Tony Perrott, and some mayors from Queensland. And we're talking to them primarily about fire ants, but I will also be talking to them about this rabbit issue. And I raise it directly with the Queensland Ag Minister as well. And I'm going to be raising this with state ministers across the country, because we do need them to be putting the pressure on. And also that funding decision is going to be a co-funding decision that all the states and territories and the federal government need to sign up to. So I've already spoken a number of times to Minister Collins about this. I know that she sees the issue. It seems that one of the problems we have is that because it's not funded, the current way that decisions are being made in the federal government means that then an offset needs to be found elsewhere. That's not good enough. You know, these sorts of invasive species outbreaks need to be treated in the same way as a fire or a flood, as something that we need to respond to, respond appropriately at scale, and treat as something that forever is going to be part of Australia and requires that ongoing research funding.
Jack, it sounds like you've got a busy job ahead of you, so I'm going to let you go. Thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Always happy to chat. Thank you.
Jack Gough is the CEO of the Invasive Species Council of Australia, and you can really hear that sense of urgency in his voice to see that funding locked in to deal with the growing rabbit populations around the country. And as you just heard him say there, treated as the same as a fire and flood. What do you make of it? 0448 922 604. I've also put a request in to speak to the Federal Agricultural Minister, Julie Collins, just to get her take on the current situation with rabbits. Yet to hear back. Hopefully something is coming soon, and I will bring that information to you as soon as it comes to light. On the text line, lots of you wanting to have your say on the topic of rabbits and invasive species. Rick says, hi team, what about getting Jackie Jarvis on the show so she can explain herself and the state's position on rabbits? Big numbers here in the Margaret River region too. Maybe I should put a request in, not just to the federal ag minister, but also to our state ag minister, see if she'll chat about it. Thanks for your thoughts, Rick. Eric says, hey, Country Hour, I live at New Nile. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, which is close to 2J, and there are no rabbits at our place. As a matter of fact, I haven't seen any for a couple of years. Well, it sounds like, Eric, you're in a lucky position there. Baron says, the Red Shield fox shoot has probably had a negative effect on rabbit control. Thanks for your thoughts, Baron. And Mike from Bridgetown says, regarding rabbit control funding to the CSIRO, the Invasive Species Council obviously didn't make a reference to climate change. If they had, the funding probably would have been approved. Such is the reality of federal Labor and what they don't stand for. Thank you, Mike. On the text line, share your thoughts if you've got something to say on this, 0448 922 604.
The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
26 past 12, and the Northern Territory's largest banana farm suffered some damage on the weekend from Cyclone Fina, losing about 40% of its fruit. The farm is at Lambell's Lagoon on the outskirts of Darwin, and it normally supplies close to 100% of the top end's banana needs. Farm manager Mark Smith says the Northern Territory will now need to import bananas from Queensland for the next few months until his farm can get back to full production after what ended up being a scary experience when the strong winds hit.
Pretty anxious waiting, you know, the lead up to the cyclone coming. So we were pretty well prepared. We got everyone working pretty hard to make sure things were prepared. We knocked quite a few leaves off some of the bays that we thought would help and less wind resistance, therefore getting those plants not around as much. But yeah, obviously it's just an anxious wait, and you have to wait and see till it's all over, come out and see what actually happened.
And so here we are at the plantation. What's your assessment of the damage?
I think it's probably better than I thought in some bays. Anything without any fruit hanging up lasted pretty well. You know, obviously if you've got 40 kilos hanging around your neck, you're going to fall over a little bit easier than if you haven't. But some of these bays, like the one we're standing out here now, it's pretty well... like 40% of those plants are over, and I'd say we've definitely lost 40% plus of our fruit that we can harvest.
Yeah, where we're standing, there's banana trees over, and the bunches that were in their blue bags are on the ground. Are they salvageable at all, that fruit?
No, there's a couple of reasons why. I mean, you know, they've been over too long, so they haven't been fed properly, and the sunburn. You don't want to harvest anything that's been in sort of runoff water either, so you've only got a very short time to pick up what you can. And we did come out a bit earlier on before the cyclone, and we filled up our harvest trailers. So we just had...
You picked as much as you could beforehand.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, we went out there and filled up everything we could, and proved to be pretty beneficial to do that. And also beneficial to knock some of the leaves off those younger bays, so, you know, limited the wind resistance and cop as much.
There's a lot of trees down where we're standing, but say some of these other trees that I can see that are standing, but their leaves are kind of in tatters. Do they have a future?
Yes, 100%. I mean, obviously, if you stress a banana plant that badly, it's going to compromise in the size of the bunch that comes out, especially anything that's got, you know, in a bunch initiation or is just about to throw a bunch. They're usually smaller, but...
But you'll leave them up and get some fruit off them.
Yeah, for sure. We'll be able to cut. And if they haven't rolled out of the ground, like that one's rolled out of the ground, so that's not as good. But the ones that have just snapped off, you know, roll out, but snap off, we can cut them off and just work on that follower to fill it. It's just going to take time, that's all.
So this is the Northern Territory's largest banana farm that supplies nearly 100% of the top end's banana needs. What's the damage here going to mean to consumers?
Oh, it means that we're going to have to access fruit from our other farms in North Queensland to supply locally until we can get back up on track, and it just takes a bit of time. Obviously, we can't plant everything at once to try and get the numbers up, because we'd pick everything at once and then have nothing.
You have to stage your planting.
Yeah, we have to stagger the planting, so we, you know, so we do spread our harvest over the year if we can, and that's the biggest thing. We will try and up it a little bit more if we can, if the plants are available. In tissue culture plants, you really should order them 12 months in advance. Whether we can get extra plants, I don't know yet.
When are you expecting to be picking fruit again?
Well, we picked this week. Yesterday we picked.
Right.
What we could was not much at all. And the stuff we picked on just before the cyclone, we processed. So I got a 26 pallets coming from our North Queensland farm.
All right, so the Queensland bananas are on their way already.
They will, yeah. We've got a contract with the chain stores, and we want to make sure that we've got enough fruit for the local people. It's not going to be as good because they're Queensland bananas, obviously.
But got a few extra Ks on them.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll just have to go from there. Look, it's going to be hard. I think for 3 weeks, next 3 weeks, we're going to sort of be wholly and solely reliant on Queensland fruit. But after that, we'll have to, I'd say it'd be 80%. Fruit from Queensland and fill up what we can.
Rightio.
In 3 months, I reckon we'll have, you know, we'll be supplying fruit from here, but it won't be 100% local.
Mark Smith is the farm manager for Darwin Fruit Farms, which is the Top End's biggest and only major commercial banana farm. He was speaking with the Northern Territory Country Hours presenter, Matt Brann. It is 29-1 here on the Country Hour. And just before we get to news headlines, this morning the federal government has announced that testing has confirmed the presence of H5 bird flu in samples collected from southern elephant seals on Heard Island, which is a subantarctic Australian external territory. Heard Island is located in the Southern Ocean, more than 4,000 kilometres southwest of Perth. And this is a serious version of avian influenza, which is highly contagious. Mainly affects birds, but it also can infect mammals and occasionally be transferred to humans. The federal government is saying these test results are not only surprising because the virus has already been found on nearby islands, but it's also saying the detection does not substantially increase the risk to Australia's mainland. 28-1. Jonathan Beale in the studio for the news headlines. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Kate. A severe weather warning is in place for parts of the Kimberley as tropical cyclone Fina moves inland. Fina crossed the WA coast last night as a Category 3. It's since been downgraded to a Category 1. The Bureau of Meteorology says isolated falls of up to 150 millimetres are expected and may lead to flash flooding. A cyclone warning is in place between the King George and Berkeley River mouths. WA's Commissioner for Children and Young People has welcomed the safe recovery of juvenile detainees from the roof of a building at Banksia Hill Detention Centre. Six detainees climbed onto the roof yesterday afternoon and threw projectiles at staff by this morning. All six had come down. No one was harmed. Jacqueline McGowan-Jones has called for compassion for the detainees. And the One Nation leader has been censured by the Senate and banned from the chamber for 7 sitting days after wearing a burqa into Parliament yesterday. Pauline Hanson will be banned from representing the Senate in any official delegations overseas. Ahead of the final vote, the government leader in the Senate, Penny Wong, accused Senator Hanson of mocking and vilifying people of the Muslim faith. More news, Kate, at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, as always, Jonathan. 27-1 on the Country Hour, and we're going to check in now with the Bureau of Meteorology. Grace Abbott is standing by. Grace, tropical cyclone Fina is slowly moving over the northeast Kimberley. Can you give me an update on that for me?
Hey, Kate. Yeah, no worries. So tropical cyclone Fina is now a Category 1 system, and as you said, it is just slowly moving inland of the northeast Kimberley coast, roughly near the Berkeley River mouth. Now, it crossed the northeast Kimberley coast around 9:30 p.m. last night as a Category 3 cyclone, but with some only very sparse observations in the area, the highest gust that we recorded was 70 kilometres per hour at Wyndham Aerodrome, which also recorded 26 millimetres before 9 a.m. Now, Fina is expected to weaken below cyclone strength this afternoon, and so therefore we're going to transition away from our tropical cyclone warning product into a severe weather warning for heavy rainfall, and just noting that Wyndham is already in a severe weather warning, so please check our website or our app for any warnings and further details. Now, as for rainfall, throughout today and also tomorrow, those heavier totals associated with decaying FINA will be very coastal. So flash flooding is certainly a hazard, but we're not expecting catchment-wide falls, so therefore we're not expecting any riverine rises. So for Wyndham today, we might see, looks about 15 to 60 millimetres. It really depends on where these bands of cloud are that wrap into the cyclone. It depends where they sit and for how long. Kalumburu and Kununurra are looking pretty similar with 5 to 20 millimetres, but again, possibly higher if some of those bands sit overhead. Now, FINA is quite small, so the rainfall is dropping to zero as you move further south towards Halls Creek and Fitzroy Crossing. Now, into tomorrow, we've got 10 to 30 millimetres, but some isolated totals of 50 to 100 millimetres nearer to the low in the North Kimberley. And again, though, decaying to less than 2 millimetres if you travel further south towards Fitzroy Crossing. And into Thursday, we're looking at below 20 millimetres for the Northeast Kimberley, possibly a little bit higher with some isolated thunderstorms. Now, on the topic of thunderstorms, they are continuing in the Kimberley and the interior for the week, and they'll drift along a trough into the inland Pilbara for Friday and Saturday. Now, further away from Tropical Cyclone FINA, these thunderstorms are likely to have little to no rainfall, and they may be gusty as well. Finally, for the north, some of the temperatures, we're seeing some heatwave conditions continuing over the remainder of the Kimberley and also the north interior. We've got 43 degrees today at Fitzroy Crossing and Telfer, and 44 for both those towns tomorrow. And with storms becoming a little bit more frequent this weekend, we will gradually see these heatwave conditions ease in the north.
Gosh, some high temps there. All right, let's move down to the Southwest Land Division. What's happening?
Yes, so we have a ridge pushing over northern and central parts of the Southwest Land Division with a couple of weak troughs and fronts that brush by the south over the coming days. So for tomorrow, we'll see less than a millimetre if you're southwest of Durian Bay to Esperance, maybe 1 to 5 millimetres if you're southwest of Bunbury to Bremer Bay. Then for Thursday, it's just less than a millimetre if you're south of Perth to Katanning to Ravensthorpe and out east of Esperance. Friday, again, is a very similar situation with less than a millimetre if you're south of Busselton to Israelite Bay. But then the ridge axis is going to drop south and it'll strengthen this weekend. So that's going to clear the weather in the south and it'll also heat our temperatures up in the west into this weekend.
Thanks, Grace, for your time.
Thank you.
It is coming up to, sorry, I should say it's 24 away from 1 on the Country Hour. And I have taken not only Belinda Varaschetti's job for the time being, but now today also Richard Hudson, because I'm going to be reading the rainfall figures this afternoon. I'm going to start in the Kimberley, where Diggers Rest had 21, Parry Creek Farm had 12 mils, Wyndham Airport 26, but I'm sure some locations will have had a little bit more rain than that out of Tropical Cyclone FINA. Moving down to the southwest now, Warner Glen 5, and then the Southern Coastal District, Albany, had 4. And that's it in the rainfall for today.
Across Western Australia, this is the Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
Well, the new head of the Bureau of Meteorology is saying it was a simple case of miscommunication which led to the news this week that the cost of redesigning their website blew out from $4 million to $96.5 million. Dr. Stuart Minchin says a big portion of the money has been spent on a backup supercomputer that they hope will ensure the website is more secure against hackers.
Originally, the Bureau was asked what the design costs for the website front end were, which was the $4 million figure. But the website front end, if you like, is just the tip of the iceberg. Underlying that is a huge system that takes tens of thousands of instruments across the Australian region, satellite imagery, brings that into a supercomputer where the modelling is done out to production systems in order to make the forecast. And the entire system had to be replaced after a hacking incident in 2015. So, yeah, the total cost of the website includes all of that back end, not just the front end.
When did you become aware of the true total figure of $96.5 million?
Well, look, I've only been in the Bureau for 2 weeks, and as soon as I started it, I started looking into this issue. It's been quite open within the Bureau, the cost of this this website. This is part of a larger program.
So if it's been open within the Bureau, why wasn't it communicated more widely? I mean, we can talk about front end and so on, but common sense would say, how much is this whole redesign, rebooting of the website cost? It's 96.5.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think there was perhaps a communication error made at the time where the exact question that was asked by the journalist at the time, which was about the website design costs, was answered rather than a more holistic answer. I can commit that on taking the helm of the Bureau, I wanted to make that as transparent as possible and be open and honest with the Australian people.
Was the minister informed of the 96.5 figure or the full figure at an earlier time, or was that only in the past week when it came out in the media?
Well, look, as I mentioned, this is part of a larger program of work that was actually signed off by Cabinet back in 2017 and has repeatedly been part of the budget updates. So the website component is about 10% of a much larger program of replacing all of the Bureau's back-end systems and processes. And that's been visible to government all the way through.
Stuart Minchin, let me read you a bit, some comments from Brad Perry. He's the Chief Executive of Grain Producers SA. He's based on Eyre Peninsula in South Australia. He's saying with that kind of expenditure, something like Doppler radar on Eyre Peninsula, where there's a black hole for that kind of technology, would have been much better spend. Do you agree the money could have been better spent?
Well, look, I think we've got to look back at the hacking incident in 2015, which really opened up the threat that hackers could take down the entire Bureau system. Imagine if we were facing a situation like Tropical Cyclone Fina and we were unable to issue a weather forecast for a week or 2 weeks period because hackers had got into our network. So this was a really urgent need to address what was a very insecure...
It's urgent, but it's taken 10 years to fix it by the sounds of that timeline.
And it's a massive project. Look, please don't misunderstand the size of this. We had to install a backup supercomputer. This is a massive investment and a huge amount of technical work.
So for the past 10 years, has the weather forecasting capabilities, has that been vulnerable until this has all been put together?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's been, progressively, this has been protected and improved, and it's really only with the latest update of the website that the front end, the web access, has actually been updated to more secure and more secure platform.
For the safety of communities and for multi-million dollar industries, like the comments that we've seen in the Adelaide Advertiser this morning from Brad Perry, are investments like Doppler in Doppler black holes, are they something the Bureau will look at?
Look, we absolutely understand that there are some communities in Australia that are still not covered by radar and would like to have radar coverage. Unfortunately, we're only funded to support the existing radar network at the moment. It's certainly, if the opportunity arises and we are funded to provide extra radars, we will do so. But at the moment, we're only able to support those radars that are already installed and we don't have the resources to maintain any more than that at this point in time. We are covering more than 95% of the Australian population with radar, but the Eyre Peninsula, Margaret River are places that are arguably next on the list if we're able to be resourced to do so.
Just finally, how important is the task of rebuilding trust between the Bureau and the public at the start of your term now?
Look, I'm coming into the Bureau. I think the Bureau is a fantastic institution full of incredibly dedicated people, dedicated to serving the Australian community. I think the Australian community understands that at times of crisis when we're standing next to them, Tropical Cyclone Fina and other emergencies. This website issue has clearly damaged some of that trust, but I hope to regain that through being open, honest and working diligently to apply remedies to that process.
Dr. Stuart Minchin is the new CEO and Director of Meteorology of the Bureau of Meteorology, and he was speaking with Sally Sara on RN Breakfast this morning. It is 16 away from 1, and on the text line, quite a few of you still wanting to chat about this rabbit issue. Tom says it's no good bleating on about getting a new Khaleesi virus. People need to learn again how to use 1080 or Pindon poisons. I use both for years on the farm, and they're still effective. Cheers, Tom. Thank you for sending in your thoughts. You can do so as well. 0448 922 604.
The Country Hour.
We exported the largest volume of lobster.
Celebrating 80 years.
Isn't that quite exciting?
The Country Hour.
Get up.
Part of your community.
Fight the bullet.
And your life.
Keep moving.
For 80 years on ABC Radio.
Well, it might not be long before you start seeing a lot more crayfish in the shops. And that's partly because the annual White's migration of Western rock lobster kicks off this week. And that's when recently molted rock lobsters turn roughly 280 degrees northwest together and they head for deeper waters off the Western Australian coast. And it's good timing for Ledge Point fisher Jay Barrett, who only has just put his boat back in the water.
This year we decided to repower the boat. It wasn't our first choice. We were looking at rebuilding our old engine, but we had a lot of trouble trying to get our parts. So we ended up pulling the trigger on a new installation. So that turned out to be quite a long and lengthy exercise. And as of this morning, we got the boat back in the water and we're about to do our startup. So yeah, it's a bit excited.
About to be mobile again. What is the cost of a new motor for a boat these days, Jay?
It's not a cheap exercise. I think the purchase price for a new engine is about $200,000. Yep. Plus, then you've got to do all your plumbing and installation costs and gearbox overhauls and everything else that goes with it. So, yeah, you know, you can literally double the price of what the engine costs by the time you installed it. Yeah. So, not cheap.
Making that sort of decision, and that's a big investment into your boat, into your business, did you need to have China back in the market to give you that confidence?
Oh, most definitely, Joe. Yeah, if we were stuck where we were with the trade ban that we had and the way the price was, there was no way we could have taken the risk and sort of spend this sort of money and go this way. We would have had to just sit tight on the old engine and creep around and hold our breath and hope that everything was all right. But knowing that our Chinese market is now returned and we've seen it firsthand that it is there and the prices are reasonably strong when they're buying. That gave us the confidence definitely to make this investment.
And the timing of this motor being ready to go is at the same time that the Whites are starting to run. The expectation is that they'll start moving, or if they haven't already. Are you expecting some pretty good catches once you are on the water?
Yeah, I think the lead up to the start of the Whites now, the weather's been quite good. The fishing pressure in the winter, especially on our part of the coast, hasn't been huge. So I'm actually quite confident that we're going to see some really, really large catches in the lead up to Christmas. The downside of that is it's not good for our price. It will push our price down, which is a natural occurrence with oversupply on the market. But I'm sort of going to push a little bit of backer boat sales again like I normally do in that Christmas period, and hopefully we can get a little bit extra there.
And is that going to be your main focus? Because it's a month until Christmas. Will you mainly focus on that domestic market for the next few weeks? What's the plan?
My plan is to try and sell as many backer boats as I can. We'll start advertising as soon as we know what day we get back fishing next week and we get back to Ledge. We'll start doing some advertising and letting people know that we will have crays available in this lead up to Christmas, and the more we can sell, the better. Yeah. We're sort of hoping we can get rid of a couple of ton at least before Christmas.
Yeah. The expectation from scientists is that there will be less whites in comparison to normal this year because the Pyrrhulus was down in 2020 and 2021, but you're still expecting that will push the price down. What is the price looking like at the moment? How are things going?
At the moment now, the price is pretty good, Joe. Small crays are still over $50, and then you move through the grades up to the big stuff and they're at $80. So the price now is quite strong, but even if DPIRB are saying that they're not expecting there to be as many whites this Christmas, this whites run, there's still going to be plenty that are going to have an effect on our beach price.
So for you, it's focusing on that domestic market and then waiting until what, Chinese New Year, lead up to Chinese New Year when the price kicks back up again?
Yes, that'll be our focus, yeah. There's a little bit at the start, just for a bit of cash flow more than anything, to finish off this new installation that we've done and, yeah, get a bit of Christmas money in the bank, and then our focus will be the Chinese New Year with our remaining quota.
I'm looking forward to enjoying some cray myself over Chrissy. That was Ledge Point fisher Jay Barrett speaking with Joe Prendergast. He's based about 100 kilometres north of Perth at Ledge Point. 11 to 1. Australia and New Zealand have just signed a milestone agreement which could give both countries faster and more efficient access to important new agricultural compounds and veterinary medicines. So that agreement is between the New Zealand Food Safety and the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, APVMA. Now, those two agencies will share the work of assessing these new products. They issued a joint media release saying this arrangement should streamline workflows, reduce duplication of effort, and deliver faster turnaround times. They also hope this agreement will position our region as a market of choice for innovative products that will benefit farmers and the wider community. And I wonder if the All Blacks and Wallabies are in the works with forming a similar alignment. It will be interesting to hear that. 10 to 1 on the Country Hour. Well, Western Australia's dairy farmers are heading into a strong production season with good pasture and hay growth helping feed the cows. But as is the case for so many, running costs are rising sharply. For example, in less than a year, electricity bills at Bannister Downs Dairy have doubled. And Managing Director Sue Daubney says margins are getting tighter and tighter.
The cows are happy because there's plenty of grass, and that's thanks to the rain that we're getting and the temperature, the ground temperature is good, so it's growing well. I guess just from a business management point of view, and that's probably more on the food processing side of things, the input costs are going up drastically month by month, and that might be your chemicals supplier or the freight supplier that, you know, we spend quite a bit on freight every day and chilling. So all of our power costs, dairy is fairly intensive. So the actual demand, the energy demand is high. And as that's doubled in the last 11 months, that certainly has a cost every day that we're very aware of.
And you just mentioned that your energy cost has doubled. What does that look like for you guys?
We probably have about 17 different energy sites, like for bore pumps and the dairies and one thing or another. But our main one is where we process our milk. And we have gas, solar power. We have 100 kilowatts of solar. And our main energy supply is grid electricity. And that has gone from $22,000 a month to $44,000 a month since November last year.
What are the margins like in the dairy industry right now? Are they pretty tight? And what does that
very
mean?
Tight.
Yeah, what does that mean for you, and how much effort goes into keeping the business running?
It's a lot of effort. Fortunately, being in food is really rewarding, and being in farming is rewarding in terms of what you do every day matters. And you're producing something that people really need and always will. So that, and you're looking after animals and you're outdoors in many cases. And when we go and win wonderful medals for our product, all of that's very rewarding. It's just managing the business side is challenging when the costs are just continually going up. And we are very aware that consumers are all watching their spending because it's getting more and more expensive to live, because everybody's experiencing this escalation, not just business. But it's really compounded when you're a manufacturer or you're in agriculture, because you're sort of absorbing everybody else's costs and then being expected to produce a product and try not to increase the cost of what you're producing, and that just doesn't work.
There are other fees that you guys are facing that are adding costs for you. How do these kinds of charges impact your ability to price products and also stay profitable at the same time?
Sometimes you do feel like you're expected to run a charity when you produce food for some reason. But, we just looked back over our last 12 months and we've spent over $898,000 in taxes. And that's a significant amount of money, and certainly a lot more money than we made in our business. And that's just continually increasing, like the containers for change, that's added 15 cents to every flavoured product that we produce. We're not allowed to pass that on. Part of the compliance with that is that that's something that business absorbs, and that's whether it's returned for recycling or not.
Do you think the industry is getting enough guidance or clarity on what net zero would actually involve in practice, and would it impact the cost and operations for you guys?
It will absolutely impact us even further on top of the challenges we already have. And I think we're already feeling a soft impact of that, which is having a big repercussions on our power pricing, because the government is subsidising the renewables so much. And there is definitely a place for renewables. I mean, we have invested in solar. If you can harness energy from the sun or anything else, that makes sense. But the drastic, you know, trying to get everybody on board with the renewables, where in some cases it's actually not economically viable, has required quite a bit of subsidisation, which is why I think we're seeing our energy prices double. I gather the targets, we're aiming for 43% reduction in emissions by 2030. And we're getting close to that now. That's 4 years away. So we're going to see more and more pressure being put on the cheap energy that we can produce to force people to be using renewable energy. And I think in farming, we kind of, like, there's been a lot of talk about this for a long time, and no one is probably really totally clear on how that's going to impact them. Once this starts to roll out, I mean, it's like going to a grain farmer. They're just lining up now for harvest and saying to them, how are you going to go if you're not allowed to use diesel? You know, you can't have any diesel to do your harvest. I don't think they'll be really impressed, because as far as I know, there's no solar powered or electric harvesters available at the moment. So they will come to a grinding halt, or have to pay a fortune to replace all of their equipment or upgrade it. And we're talking millions of dollars. So many of them might think it's just time to stop, sell their farms if the next generation isn't showing an interest, and move on, because they're really significant costs. Then when it costs more for them, our grain's going to cost more for us. And this is this compound effect of everything sort of coming back to the manufacturer. So the consequence for the consumer will be a really big spike in the price of their food. Or the alternative is the food's brought in from countries that haven't signed up to the Paris Accord and are just being as competitive as possible and having much lower input costs as a consequence.
Bannister Downs Managing Director Sue Daubney speaking with Rachel Boothman. 4 minutes away from one. Well, about 9,500 sheep were sold at Mouchet this morning. Almost 3,700 of those were lambs. Terry Birkin, can you please run me through all the details?
Hi, Kate. There was an increase in supply from last week, mostly in older sheep numbers and around 800 more lambs. Trade and heavy lambs were in reasonable volumes, while a large percentage of store lambs were showing signs of the drying season. Values on air freight weights and better store lambs with a quicker turnover potential lifted $8 to $10, while heavier lambs remained firm to slightly dearer. Mutton across the board recorded gains of $10 to $15 a head, with competition from a full buying field filling orders. There were several runs of light-framed and dry-skinned store lambs selling from $31 to $70, while store lambs with better potential lifted $10, ranging from $80 to $190, and air freight weights from $170 to $204 a head. Heavier lambs remained firm on last week, with trade weights selling from $183 to $238 and heavy lambs from $230 to $272 a head. Lighter merino weather hoggets sold from $136 to $180, while heavier weights made $190 to $230 a head. Plain merino ewe hoggets were making $127 to $170, while heavy weights sold to a top of $221 a head. The best of the crossbred hoggets returned $178 to $256, and younger rams sold to a top of $270. Store mutton sold from $140 to $196, while medium ewes returned $170 to $242, and heavy ewes sold to a top of $255 a head. Heavy weathers also gained $8 to $10, selling from $220 to $260, while mature rams sold from $81 to $221 a head. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Terry. And exact figures were 3,680 lambs, 5,870 sheep, which is a total of 9,550. That's up on last week by 2,848. 2-1 here on the Country Hour. And the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins, has got back to me on that earlier issue we were discussing on rabbits. She has declined an interview, but her department has just sent me a statement saying that the Australian government is committed to working with state and territory governments, which are responsible for on-ground management of invasive species to help protect Australia's environment and agriculture. The government, under the Supporting Communities Manage Pest Animals and Weeds program, is investing $1.2 million towards rabbit control projects to improve control tools, capacity building, and coordinating management. It then goes on to say that this investment is supporting researchers, governments, and industry to collectively manage wild rabbit populations, including agreeing to a national rabbit biocontrol pipeline strategy. It is a shame that the minister wasn't available for an interview this time, but maybe one day she will chat to me here on the Country Hour. And just before I let you go, a bit of a food recipe idea has been sent through from Braden in Quiriding. He says, I have a very tasty honey soy glazed barbecue rabbit recipe. Maybe you can share it with us, Braden. Thank you for your thoughts. It is 1 o'clock. It is news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.